Hey. Okay. Good afternoon or good midday, everyone. It's good to see so many people in the room, especially for these hybrid sessions. I remember a time when there was a room as big as this and only 10 people were there, so it's really good to see the interest in hybrid exchange deployments. Before diving into the content, just let me talk a little bit about myself. I'm Michael van Horenbeek, or Van Horenbeek, depending on which language you speak. And I've been involved with hybrid deployments while dinosaurs still walked the face of the earth, or I still had hair. So it's up to you to decide which one was the least long ago. And I'm here to talk about all the beautiful stuff in hybrid deployments. Today we're going to walk through a wealth of different items. And I'm going to try and keep it light because I know it's noon. Some of you are used to having, their lunch right now. I've seen some chips being eaten here and there. So I'll make sure you'll survive this 1 hour and 15 minutes and you can go out to lunch in one piece. So I work as a product director for Inao, where I am involved, amongst other things, doing hybrid deployments. I don't work for Microsoft, so you will be getting a non-biased view from me today. You will get a view of what hybrid deployments are, and I will tell you the good and the bad stuff. Mostly good. I'm going to be brutally honest. There used to be a time when I was talking about hybrid deployments, and there were a lot of things, side notes I had to, catch up with. But today, things are pretty straightforward and pretty easy to follow. So our agenda for today looks like a little bit like this. We're going to talk about hybrid scenarios. When is a hybrid deployment in place? What are the different hybrid deployments in Office 365? Because obviously there is Exchange, which is one part, but there's also Lync and SharePoint. So we'll briefly touch upon that in just a few minutes. And then dive into the hybrid fundamentals, the basics. What do you need for a hybrid deployment? Why do you need it? Why does it matter? And the reason why I keep coming up with these is not because it's super easy. It's because it's super important. And most of the issues that we see with hybrid deployments when troubleshooting them is because the basics aren't covered well enough, or they're done wrong, or there is an issue there. It is seldom something that has to do with Exchange. Granted, there are some issues that you can run into, typically with Exchange, but most of the things that we see is dirsync-related, ADFS-related, anything that entails that entire hybrid deployment. So that's why those fundamentals are really important. Then we'll talk about the deployment process. How do you go from having no hybrid deployment to a hybrid deployment? And we'll focus on Exchange 2013 here, but I'll call out some stuff with Exchange 2010 as well. We'll also talk about the hybrid configuration wizard. What is it? What does it actually do for you? And how do you benefit from that hybrid configuration wizard? After which, we will dive into some of the more technical and difficult scenarios like multi-organization hybrid deployments, which, especially for larger environments or mergers, are really important. And then talk about migration issues, some of the common pitfalls there, some of the things you might see when you're actually out in the field doing these hybrid migrations. So first of all, why deploy Hybrid Exchange? And maybe a quick show of hands, who is already running a Hybrid Exchange deployment today? So it's not even the majority of the room, but quite a large part of you are already running. And the truth is there are many, many reasons why an organization might choose to go into a Hybrid Exchange deployment. But mainly it is because of the user experience that you have. As an administrator, is it extra work? Yeah, sure. There are some things that you need to configure, there are some things that you need to maintain, and there are some things that you need to take into account when managing a hybrid deployment. But in the end, it is not about us deploying it, it is about the end user experience. And when we take a look at a non-hybrid deployment where you have several organizations, you typically end up in a scenario where one person could email the other person. For instance, if you don't have a hybrid deployment, let's say that you're migrating to Office 365 from an Exchange on-premises environment and you're using a staged migration. Then you only have email coexistence, right? You don't have any FreeBSD, any of the advanced features, and this is pretty much how that would look like. When you email from on-premises to the cloud or the other way around, you would see that one person is outside of your organization, even though that person could be sitting right next to you. Well, when we set up that hybrid deployment and we move the mailbox cross-premises, so from on-premises to Office 365, that behavior changes. For the end user, it is seamless. They don't see any difference whether that user is on-premises or whether that user is in the cloud or both in the cloud. It doesn't really matter to them, and that is what counts. On top of that, the experience from getting from on-premises to Office 365 to Exchange Online is pretty seamless as well. It is a native mailbox move. This is one of the key advantages that you have over using other solutions, for instance, for moving from on-premises to the cloud, is that you can do those mailbox moves while the user stays online. They can continue working. It's as if you would be moving a mailbox from one database to the other database on-premises. So these are really strong selling points, but also the best points in a hybrid deployment, right? So taking that into account, let's take a look at some of the scenarios in Office 365. And obviously, as I said, there is not only Exchange. Exchange is the easiest part. It is the part where typically most organizations start with. If they're thinking about Office 365 and they have Exchange on-premises, then it's very likely, and that's also what I see in the field, that a lot of companies are going to Exchange Online first. But there's more to that than just Exchange. There is that Azure part, Azure AD. That entire identity, hybrid identity stuff, where you have DirSync, which is a requirement, after all, for hybrid deployments that you need to set up. So there is that hybrid identity. And as we move forward, there are new features being announced in Azure. Pretty much almost every week, I see new stuff coming up. So that's going to be more and more important in the future, not only with relations to Exchange Online, but more in general. And then there is that Exchange Online part. And when you take a look at the slide here, this is also typically the order I would recommend someone to go out and deploy. Start with, obviously, DirSync because it's a requirement, but start with that hybrid identity stuff. Then set up Exchange Online in a hybrid deployment. And if you want to go all in and you're going to do more hybrid deployments, then go with SharePoint and then go with Link hybrid workloads. So this is kind of the order that I would recommend people to start deploying it. And in the end, in the back end, totally invisible to users or administrators, all these components, they work together. And that comes to its right when you take a look at the features that you're being offered in Exchange Online. Site mailboxes, for instance, that just works out of the box. You sign up for Office 365, and there it is, because it's already set up. So all these back-end services, Exchange, SharePoint, Link, they communicate, they work with one another using OAuth, right? And that OAuth piece is rather important because we're going to talk, not at length and not that much, but we're going to talk about 5 to 10 minutes about OAuth and what it means to Exchange and Exchange Online. Because it's a new addition that has been added there, and it's the way forward. But let's not steal the thunder from our slides later on, and we'll keep it for that. So when taking a look at the hybrid Exchange deployment, more in-depth here, there is that DirSync component. Why is it there? Well, most of the documentation you will read is that it tells you that you will get a unified global address list, and that's basically what it does. But it does much more than that. It is the enabler for a hybrid deployment because it manages the attributes that flow cross-premises between on-premises and Office 365. And even with write-back, some of the attributes are written back to on-premises. And that enables some of the features which you definitely need or which make part of that hybrid deployment. So once you have that DirSync, AADSync, FIM, any of the identity solutions that are appropriate, which we will talk about in a minute as well, once you have set those up, you run the hybrid configuration wizard, and once you're done, you can start using these hybrid workloads. So the hybrid workloads, there are about 3-4 of them, depending on how you look at that. And first of all, there is secure mail flow, which ensures that messages being sent cross-premises between on-premises environment and Office 365 are always sent encrypted using TLS. That is rather important, both from a functionality point of view, but also from a security point of view. That's being taken care of by the hybrid configuration wizard using certificates and the namespaces and all that. So that's one important part. Then there is the thing called Exchange Federation, sharing of data, mail tips, free busy requests, all that good stuff that gives you the coexistence, the rich coexistence, the experience for your end user, which kind of ties in with the last point, the native mailbox moves, which not only allow you to easily onboard a mailbox, so move it from on-premises to Office 365, but also offload the mailbox quite easily. And that's basically the only solution that allows you to do that just like that. Just move mailboxes back and forth, continue to be emailing back and forth. And it's right there that DirSync plays an important role. Because when you're moving mailboxes back and forth, attributes change. And in order to be able to continue mailing to a mailbox that has just been sent to Office 365, that's where that comes in and is really important. So as a sort of takeaway here, especially when you're deploying DirSync, before you start doing that, you need to make sure that the on-premises environment, your Active Directory, is capable. Obviously, they are capable because it's an appliance reading Active Directory, but if your Active Directory is a mess, and believe it or not, there are some pretty messy environments out there, then you'll probably get into issues later on. So the principle here is garbage in is garbage out. So better make sure that whatever you start with is a healthy environment. And that's also one of the things, or the starting point where I want to start here is when planning your environment, what do you need to think of? Well, it's much more than only Exchange. Exchange is just a small part of the Exchange hybrid deployment, which is kind of a contrast to what the name says. But it's much more than that. So similar to a pilot when he flies a plane, he knows the plane, he knows how to fly, but still, before they take off, they have their checklist that they have to go through. Well, here it's not written by rule that you have to go through a checklist, but the Exchange Deployment Analyzer, it is a super great tool. I use it all the time just to make sure I don't forget something by mistake. If you go through the Exchange Deployment Assistant, it's a wizard-driven content engine, if you will, where you answer a bunch of questions like, I'm running Exchange on-premises, Exchange 2007. I want to do Exchange 2013 coexistence with hybrid. I do or do not have Edge servers. And then you click, yes, this is what I want to have. And you'll get your entire step-by-step what you need to do on how to deploy hybrid. It gives you a great starting point to take a look at, okay, did I think about everything? It'll also talk about all the identity stuff, which is important as well. Now, as I said earlier, make sure that whatever your starting point is, it's healthy. That's not only true for Active Directory, but it's also especially true for Exchange. Even though that we've been living and working with Exchange for quite a while, and we are, especially the Exchange people, are accustomed to Autodiscover, there's still a lot of customers that do not properly publish or use Autodiscover today. Well, let me break it to you. If you do not properly configure Autodiscover, or you have not published it as it should, your hybrid deployment will cause you a lot of grief. It is a very important part. So if you start, and that's actually something I typically do because I come in as a consultant at customers, I have no idea of their environment. The Exchange Remote Connectivity Analyzer is my best friend. I just run the Exchange Remote Connectivity Analyzer, and I make sure that it gives me the green ticky-ticky for all the workloads that I need for my hybrid deployment. Exchange Web Services, Autodiscover, and I make sure that it tells me you're good to go. Only if the Remote Connectivity Analyzer tells me you're good to go, I will move forward. If it's not the case, then I take a step back and I correct whatever there is. So make sure that you're in a supported scenario and that it is healthy and that it works as it should. Now, interestingly enough, there's sometimes not all environments are pristine. Not all environments are only Exchange 2013 or only Exchange 2010 or even only Exchange 2007. You can have a mix and match of different versions. Obviously, there are some limitations there. You cannot use Exchange 2013 as long as there is an Exchange 2003 server in the environment, but you could just as easily set up hybrid using an Exchange 2010 when there is still an Exchange 2003 server in the environment, right? Now, when we start mixing and matching those servers, there is an additional thing that we need to take into account, the coexistence between all those versions there. And the general rule, and it's not only a rule, it is a support statement as well, is that when you are in a hybrid deployment, Autodiscover must point, and that's also true if you're in a just on-premises environment, to the latest version. So if you decide to deploy Exchange 2013 for the sake of a hybrid deployment, which I can apply in some scenarios, then make sure that Autodiscover and all the other namespaces go to that Exchange 2013 server so that it can then distribute the workload internally or connect to the backend servers, which may or may not be a different version. That is especially important for hybrid workloads because this is the point of ingress into your environment where Office 365 will connect into for auto-discover, for migrations, for the mailbox moves. So if you do not have the latest version reporting to Office 365, let's say that you keep your auto-discover on Exchange 2007, you will get a very bad experience. First of all, things will not work or might work differently or will cause issues. So does that mean that you have to go through a migration on premises? Well, sort of. It is something that you need to take into account. If you only have 2007 today, then you need to change your namespaces to Exchange 2010, which might or might not incur some work on your end, but it's something you need to take into account and you definitely need to be aware of. So when you are moving to Office 365 and you're using that hybrid deployment for the sole purpose of migrating over a longer term period of time, right? How do you size that servers? Those servers, that one server, those multiple servers. Well, the truth is there is no specific guidance to hybrid workloads. It is no different than an on-premises environment. Mail flowing through a hybrid server going to Office 365 is just as mail that would flow on-premises. Client access connections to that hybrid deployment, to that hybrid server, to that client access server is just like if it would be an on-premises user. Obviously, over time, as more users get to Office 365, the load on those servers will actually diminish. So that being said, make sure that you take that into account when you are deploying hybrid. If you have an array of client access servers which can support the load of your 10, 15, 20,000 users or even 500 users, then you should be okay for the same workload in Office 365. There's nothing specific there. Now, does that mean that you cannot separate the traffic for Office 365 for a hybrid deployment? Yes, you could. Do you want to do that? Well, it's a discussion I'm willing to have depending on your situation. But typically, I would say if you have a CAS array, Exchange 2010 or 2013, I'm not referring to the object, just an array of client access servers behind a load balancer, then you're good to go. You can move mailboxes during the day, which obviously will create a load on your client access servers, on your mailbox server in the environment as well. So you could theoretically separate some client access servers or some hybrid servers, if you will, and just taxate them for hybrid migration workloads. On the other hand, that means that you have to set up a different set of servers, that you have to maintain them separately from your environment, which in the end causes you more work. So I would prefer taking the approach there is to schedule my mailbox moves during the night when my servers aren't busy at all. But obviously, it really depends on your own situation. Some companies can and cannot do that, especially when you are in geographically different locations. We see that sometimes organizations have their primary hybrid servers, and then they have a set of servers in a remote location solely used for mailbox migrations. So if you move a mailbox from on-premises to Office 365, and we'll talk about the process later on in this presentation, you will see that you can define multiple migration endpoints. By default, the migration endpoint is the one that is being returned by AutoDiscover, which is your primary endpoint pointing to your hybrid deployment servers that are part of your hybrid deployment that you configure during the hybrid configuration wizard. But you can define an endpoint in Asia Pacific or in the United States or in Europe, depending on where your primary servers are, so that you can just pull mailboxes directly through there. So that's perfectly possible. How about high availability then? Well, that's also a different question. Again, it is no different as high availability on premises, but because you're a hybrid Exchange server, it's not a different server role. It is a client access mailbox server or a client access and a mailbox server or combined, whatever. It's no different. It is Exchange 2010 or Exchange 2013, so the same rules apply. And I would also encourage to just tackle it the same way that you do your on-premises environment. But as I said earlier, high availability for hybrid deployments is not only about Exchange. There is that DirSync, AADSync component, which is critical because think about this. DirSync goes down. Does it affect your users? No, it does not. They will keep working with their environment, no questions asked. That'll just work fine. but will you be able to do a mailbox move? Yeah. New users, that'll be a problem. So the problem, you know, isn't obvious immediately. So the need to have something, you know, that fails over when the nursing server goes down isn't there. But it's something that you need to take into account. Something that what I see quite regularly is an environment just deploying a standby nursing server and making sure that if the other one goes down and they cannot recover them, that server, that they just pick up the new server, configure it for nursing, and it goes off again. Obviously, there are some caveats there. I mean, you need to make sure that the nursing server is running the same version. If you have filtering configured on the nursing server, that you also have the same exclusions on the new nursing server. But that's one way to go about. If you're using ADFS, which is not a requirement for a hybrid deployment, very important, because a lot of people think I need ADFS. You do not. It's mostly used. Actually, I think almost every hybrid deployment that I see is using ADFS today. But you could also use password sync. But let's assume that you have ADFS in your environment. Well, whether you're using Exchange Online, Exchange hybrid deployments, SharePoint or Link, if ADFS goes down, game over. Your users will not be able to access their services in Office 365. Your on-premises users, they will still be able to connect to the mailbox because obviously they're connecting directly to Exchange on-premises. But anyone else trying to go to their Office 365 mailbox will have issues there. So again, you can see where I'm going here that when planning and sizing and thinking about high availability for such a hybrid deployment, there is much more to think about. And then by extension, we can go further than that, and then what do you do when you're deploying ADFS on premises? Do you have a single internet connection? If you do, well, what happens if that internet connection goes down? And I'll get to you in just a minute. So, I mean, that's all things to think about. And luckily, there are solutions, hybrid Azure deployments. You can leverage Azure virtual machines to extend your ADFS environment, your nursing environment into Azure to have some sort of resiliency and high availability there. So yes, you had a question. If you have a question, please use the microphone so that everyone can hear you. And I'll be taking some questions in between to break up a little bit, but yes.
Yeah, now correct me if I'm wrong, but one of the sessions that I've had earlier this week pointed out that the latest version of the AAD Connect or whatever you want to call it, the next version, will actually be supporting both the ADFS connectivity and the password sync to take into consideration if the federated server or the connectivity towards that goes down, that your users still have the possibility to log on with their password that is synced. Is that correct, or do I understand it that it's not the case from what you just said?
It is actually correct. As a matter of fact, yesterday, the new AAD Sync tool, which was released in September, officially supports password sync. It did not 2 days ago. So as of yesterday, you can use AAD Sync to do password sync. The thing is, if you have a federated identity, it is federated. If ADFS goes down, you need to switch it back to password sync if you want to do that. Now, the process of switching it back from ADFS to password sync is a process which isn't instantaneous. It takes a few hours. So if you can recover your ADFS servers or your ADFS infrastructure or anything that, you know, brings it back up online within those in that time frame, I would prefer repairing ADFS so that authentication works again. If you know that you cannot, that your ADFS farm, whatever you have, is beyond repair for the next 3 days, then I would run out and then switch those federated identities to password sync, which is now a viable solution with AAD sync too. And then within a matter of 3-4 hours, you're back up and running, right? So yes, it is a valid solution, but there are some other planning stuff to keep in mind. I actually refer to one of the identity sessions in the track resources because we can have a talk for half a day about all the identity options and how to tackle them. And I will go a little bit more in detail about them later, but yeah, it's definitely possible. So now that we have talked about some of the planning stuff, sizing and HA, let's see what the process is of going hybrid, doing a hybrid deployment. Well, first of all, assuming that you have an environment with an Exchange 2007 or 2010 on-premises and that you decide to go with an Exchange 2013 hybrid server. Again, you could just as easily do a hybrid configuration with an Exchange 2010 on-premises But again, we'll focus here on 2013. So assuming that you have your environment here, first thing that you would do is make sure that your environment is ready, and you would start by deploying the cumulative updates, the update rollups for your Exchange 2010 and 2007 servers, so that they are ready for Exchange 2013. Sure. Second part, we'll deploy Exchange 2013. We'll make sure that the server, the Exchange 2013 organization is properly sized, configured, and that that coexistence between the Exchange 2013 and the Exchange 2010 environment is working as we expect. We configure the external URLs, and prior to Exchange 2013 Service Pack 1, you also had to manually configure the MRS proxy, which is important for mailbox moves, but you know, given that you have to use Service Pack 1 or later for hybrid deployment, you don't need to do that anymore. It's being taken care of in the HCW. So you do that. Configure certificates. Yes, they need to be public certificates from a third-party trusted resource. That is a given. You make sure they are properly configured there as well. And then you publish those protocols, EWS, SMTP, and AutoDiscover, which is the next step. You point AutoDiscover to Exchange 2013. And once that is done, once you switched over the namespace to Exchange 2013 and all that is working perfectly, you have the remote connectivity analyzer giving you the AOK again, then that's when you run the hybrid configuration wizard, which runs you through a bunch of steps, does a bunch of things for you, and I'll dive into that in just a minute, what it actually does, and be done with it. Once you're ready to move your mailboxes to Office 365 just like that. So it's a fairly straightforward process. There might be some extra steps here and there that you have to take into account for your own environment, but it is pretty straightforward. And as you will see, we've come a long way, or actually Microsoft has come a long way, and I'm very happy with everything that they're doing right now in the hybrid configuration wizard. So let's talk about that wizard. Let's talk a little bit about its history. In the very early days of hybrid deployments, there was a very thick guide, about 72 pages long, for configuring a hybrid deployment. Who are the brave souls who have attempted doing that? Okay, so these are all the experts on hybrid deployments. It was painful, it was a long process, and in the end, you were lucky if it worked. Microsoft learned a great deal from that, and then along came Exchange 2010 Service Pack 2. And they had something called the Hybrid Configuration Wizard, which reduced those 72 pages to a bunch of pages and a wizard that you had to go through. Was it great? No. Was it good? Yes. Much better than what it was before? Absolutely. Could it be better? Absolutely yes. And that's what they did in Exchange 2013. Exchange 2013 no longer has the management console. They use a web-based interface, the AAC. So the Hybrid Configuration Wizard moved to the AAC. And they took away some of the quirks that were in the older version. They added some new stuff there. The new Hybrid Configuration Wizard is actually adaptive, is much better at configuring all the transport-related stuff. It's much better, or it actually integrates with the Edge Transport Server. So if you have an Edge Transport Server for your hybrid deployment, it will take care of the configuration, which was not the case before. So it became much better. But does it stop there? No. Because, believe it or not, Exchange Online is a moving train. It moves, and it moves quite fast. So whatever you do on premises, you need to move along. There are things that you need to keep up with. So what happened in Service Pack 1 is they made some changes, or actually they made them earlier, but they announced the changes around the Service Pack 1 timeframe that you now can have multi-organization hybrid deployments. I will talk about those in just a minute, so bear with me here. That's one of the improvements made there. And they announced the support for Exchange 2013 Edge, well, mainly because the Exchange 2013 Edge server didn't exist prior to Service Pack 1. So that's why they added it there. And then more recently, in CU5, they added even more stuff, like automatic configuration of OAuth. There you have it again, that OAuth thing. And we'll be talking about that in just a minute. And they also announced support for the Greater China region, because that used to be a problem for them getting Office 365 in the China environment. The thing to remember here is, you know, come a long way, but a lot of companies are using hybrid deployments. And the reason is it's just really easy. And to me, it is by far the best way to tip your toe in the water and see if you like Office 365. Chances are you might like it, I'm pretty sure you will, but if you don't, or if you run into some issues, which I believe the hybrid deployment is, you know, one of the strongest points, instead of planning and planning and planning and planning for ages and ages and then moving a mailbox after having done 10,000 tests, wouldn't it just be better to, you know, prepare a little, decent enough, and then move a mailbox? And if there is something that you didn't take into account, an application that stopped working because you didn't know of the existence, we all know it happens, especially in larger environments. You know, you can go out to the business units and tell them, tell me all your applications that you use and whether or not they work with email. Well, if you get a full list of all the applications, job well done. But usually there is something, you know, people forget about. And then when you move that mailbox and you see that that stops working, they call you screaming like, hey, I can't do this anymore, then it's just easy enough to move the mailbox back and worry about that later. That's the power for a hybrid migration. Anyway, let's talk about the wizard and what the wizard does. It runs through a bunch of steps, and it is very smart about it. Good thing that it is smart so that you don't have to be. So the first thing that the hybrid configuration wizard does is it'll create a hybrid configuration object. It'll create that object in Active Directory. You don't see it, but it's there. If you want to see it, you use ADSiEdit, and you can find the object, but that's not the point. Creates the object, walks you through the wizard, which configures that object, adds attributes to that object, and there it is. And then afterwards, what it will do is it will create the so-called desired state by going through that wizard. It will then connect using remote PowerShell to your on-premises Exchange environment, and it will connect to your Exchange Online environment. It doesn't use any magic or trickery there. It is just a remote connection, just like you would do that. Even more so, it will do that running as you, as the administrator. During the hybrid configuration wizard, and when I go through the screenshots, you will see that, it'll ask you for two sets of credentials. It'll ask you your on-premises credentials for your on-premises environment and your Office 365 tenant admin credentials so that it can make the necessary configurations. So it is not running as a special service account or God mode-like thingy. It's just using your tenant credentials to make the configuration changes. It does so in a specific order so that you don't have to go through 72 pages of documentation to do that yourself. So once it establishes those remote connections, it will read the desired configuration. It will read the current configuration and kind of create the so-called, what I like to call a delta configuration. It knows what it needs to configure or what it has already done, and then it will actually go out and make the changes in both the on-premises environment and Office 365. This also means that if you configure your hybrid configuration wizard and you go through the wizard again and you do not make any changes, it will not reapply those changes. It will not do like Exchange 2010 used to do. You run the wizard, it does the configuration, you run it again, it does it again. It runs the same commands. The hybrid configuration wizard in 2013 is much smarter about it. It will also see when something changed, and then it will reapply the change that you made through the hybrid configuration wizard, which is pretty good. So how does that look like to you? And I'm not going to do an interactive demo here. But basically, when you modify the hybrid configuration object, it's a wizard that will run you through a few steps. First of all, asking you the client access servers that you need, the ingress point into your on-premises environment, the point where all the email comes in, unless you have an Edge Transport server configured as well, but we'll talk about that in a minute. Second step is it will ask you for the mailbox servers because that's the source where all outgoing mail flow starts from. So that's where it will create the connectors to Exchange Online to Office 365. We'll then check the certificate or ask you to configure or ask you to pick the certificate that is used on the transport servers, on both the client access server and the mailbox servers for TLS encryption. That's the next step. And then asks you the remote migration endpoint, the Exchange Web Services endpoint, where Office 365 will connect to do a mailbox move. This is the first one, the one that I talked about, the default one, but you can create new migration endpoints afterwards, but that's not something you do in the hybrid configuration wizard. There's one thing I didn't show you here, because basically we're not running the hybrid configuration wizard for the first time here. We're modifying an existing one. But when you run the hybrid configuration wizard for the first time, it'll also ask you which domains you want to add to the hybrid configuration. Right? That's the very, very first step. And that's required for all the Exchange Federation stuff that it will configure for you. When we're talking about OAuth in just a minute, we'll talk about Exchange Federation as well. But just keep that in mind. Once we're done there, you enter your on-premises credentials, you enter your online credentials, and then you're ready to go. You press the update button, and then you wait. You wait a little longer. Maybe you wait a little more. Configures a free busy configuration. And within a matter of 10 minutes, maybe a little less, maybe a little more, you're done with it. It's really as easy as that. If you don't believe me, try it out. Anyway, we've covered the basics of the hybrid deployment. Let's talk about some of the advanced scenarios. And I realize that these advanced scenarios are not for everyone, but they are important, though, especially the multi-organization hybrid deployments, which I talked about earlier. So previously, prior to Exchange 2013 Service Pack 1, you could have only a single Exchange organization in a hybrid deployment with Exchange Online. So you had a one-to-one relationship between an Exchange organization and Office 365. Granted, you could have multiple account forests and a single Exchange resource forest, but you were still limited to that one forest. In organizations that are in the process of migrating to Office 365 and then go into a merger, or organizations that have not yet consolidated their on-premises environments, that was an issue because you could not go hybrid. So that's why now in Exchange 2013 you can have multiple Exchange organizations on premises, similar to what you can see here on screen, where you have organization A and organization B, each have their hybrid deployment to that single tenant. So you can use the hybrid migration method to consolidate into one tenant in Office 365 without going to a consolidated forest on premises first, which is a really good thing. A lot of the improvements that we will see just about in AAD Sync are tied to this scenario as well, because previously you had to use FIM to make that work. But FIM is quite difficult to work with, especially in relationship to this. But let's talk about that when we get there. So how does that look like? Use the same principle as before. How do you go about deploying a multi-organization Exchange hybrid deployment? Well, first of all, you prepare the organization. Each environment, and that is obviously something that you need to take into account there, must be running Exchange 2013 Service Pack 1. So Contoso and Fabricam each need to have 2013 Service Pack 1. You create a two-way forest trust. You have to do that manually. You do that. It's not the hybrid configuration wizard which will do that for you. You set it up between Fabricam and Contoso, or Company A and Company B. Right? Once you have set that up, you configure Mailflow. The hybrid configuration wizard will not configure coexistence between the on-premises forests. So you configure coexistence between those forests, make sure that you can send emails back and forth. The easiest way of doing it is making sure that each environment has their own primary namespace, fabricam.com, contoso.com, but you could also use a shared namespace, but that will only make your deployment more difficult. Anyway, you've done that. You configure directory synchronization. You cannot use DirSync, the older version, but you can use AAD Sync or you can use FIM. We'll talk about the differences between both, but the option is yours. Why do you need it there? Well, obviously for object distribution or object synchronization, not only between the on-premises forest and Office 365, but also between the on-premises forests. And why is that important? Well, when you're working with one another, user in Company A, user in Company B, and Company A decides to move that user into Office 365, then Company B needs to know that user moved to Office 365. And that's where that central identity management platform, AAD Sync, FIM, any other solution that is supported, comes into play, because it'll detect that a mailbox is being moved to Office 365 and it will update the attributes in Office 365, in the source forest, and also in all the other related on-premises forests. So that's the glue that makes everything work there. Once you have done that, you run the hybrid configuration wizard, which will take care of setting up a hybrid configuration between Forest 1 and setting up a hybrid configuration in Forest 2. You run the hybrid configuration wizard in each forest. It's not that you run it once in Fabricom or once in Contoso, and it will take care of both environments. You need to run it separately. Okay. The takeaway here is that you need to take care of the coexistence between both environments. So the ADFS and password sync, I'm not going to dive into that here because it's more related to something else, but you can use either of both as we established earlier. But as I said, the key takeaway is that you need to take care of the coexistence on premises. If you have two forests, great. It isn't something new. Coexistence between exchange forests on premises has been done before. The more forests you have, the more difficult it becomes. But it's something that you need to take into account, right? So, as I said, what are your options here for that identity management piece? Well, you've got two options. Basically, use AAD sync, which would be the preferred way because it's easy to set up. It's very similar to DirSync, and it gives you the wizard that you can go through. Now, that wizard allows you to connect to all the Active Directory forests, answer some questions like, how do you want to synchronize objects between those forests? Next, next, finish, and it does all that for you. But it is limited. Up until yesterday, you couldn't do password sync, so that was a problem, but today you can. But what you cannot do in Azure AAD sync is connect to a non-Active Directory directory on premises. So if you are using a SQL database, which is quite common in some universities, for instance, then you have to revert back to using the FIM connector in Office 365. If I recall correctly, there was a document on the internet which said that in the future they will make improvements into AAD sync, which will allow you to connect to SQL and other sources as well. But right now, there's still the Office 365 connector in FIM, which allows you to do that. Okay, so let's talk about OAuth. I mentioned it a few times. What is it? And how do I configure it, and why do I need it? Well, first of all, if you're running Exchange 2013 Service Pack, no, CU5 or later, at the end of the hybrid configuration wizard, you will see a button, the configure button, at the end of the HTW. If you click that button will launch a new wizard, and that wizard will actually configure OAuth for you. Why do you need it? Cross-premises discovery searches. If you do discovery searches across archives, mailboxes into environments, and you want to include them in a single discovery search, then you would need to set up OAuth in Exchange 2013, Service Pack 1 or later, right? It's also being used for free busy requests in Service Pack 1 or later deployments, or especially in the GCR, Greater China region, because they don't use or have the Federation Gateway there. Now, a lot of you might have not seen the button. And there is a reason why you don't see the button. If you are in a mixed environment, so if you still have an Exchange 2007 or an Exchange 2010 server, despite the fact that you're using an Exchange 2013 CU5 or later version, you will not see the configure button. Which means that if you want to use OAuth, you have to do it manually. It's a good thing that it's well documented on TechNet. There's a bunch of steps that you need to go through, and there are some scripts that will help you setting up OAuth. Again, do you need to do that? No. But keep in mind that it is the way forward, so sooner or later, OAuth is going to be prevalent enough so that you need it. And if you want to do the discovery searches today, then OAuth is definitely something you want to take into consideration. And to be quite honest, it is not that difficult to set up, even if you have to do it manually. Obviously, I'm all for doing it automatically using the wizard, and it does a really good job. But if it's not the case in your environment, no worries. The only thing that I wanted to add there, some of us being consultants, what I tend to do is when I set something up, before I start using it, I test it, right? Now, because things move so fast, especially in some of the workshops I've been giving, people set up a hybrid configuration wizard, and within 5 minutes, they try and move a mailbox. Within 10 minutes, they want to see free busy flowing all across. Well, if that's the case, keep in mind that if you run the hybrid configuration wizard and it does OAuth for you, or if you set up OAuth manually, there is a small delay. So once you set up OAuth, take a walk, take a rest. Give yourself a pat on the shoulder because you run through the entire wizard. Everything is up and running. It takes about 45 minutes before you can actually use and test the OAuth configuration. So don't panic and go out screaming like, oh, it doesn't work and I did everything right. It's normal. So just pointing that out. It's not a big deal because, you know, if you have change management and all that stuff, chances are by the time you go through the process, this works anyway. But if you're doing it in a lab, which I recommend you try out, keep that in mind and just know that it might take a while. So what is the difference between DAuth and OAuth? Well, DAuth in Exchange 2013 uses the Federation Gateway. It is a sort of a third-party broker that you use to authenticate between Exchange on-premises and Exchange Online, for instance, for FreeBSD requests. And I'll be using the FreeBSD requests as an example, too, to illustrate how it works. What it does is it uses the organization relationships to establish which organization you allow to get your FreeBSD information with, or that can actually query your FreeBSD information, and you can be quite granular with what you share with that organization. OAuth, on the other hand, it doesn't use a Federation Gateway. It leverages Azure. It leverages the auth server in Azure. It doesn't use the organization relationships anymore. It uses the IOC, the intra-organization connector. And right now, it doesn't allow you to be granular. I have no idea whether or not Microsoft will make it granular, but I think they will. I mean, would be the logical choice. So right now, today, there is a, I'd say, feature gap. You win some features by using OAuth, but you lose some features by having OAuth. And that is why the Hybrid Configuration Wizard does both for you. It will set up OAuth, but it will also set up the organization relationships and the trust with the Federation Gateway so that you can have the best of both worlds and everything works. So what features work with OAuth? As I said, it's mainly the cross-premises discovery between archives. So an on-premises mailbox and archive in the cloud, on-premises mailbox, mailbox in the cloud with the discovery search from on-premises. Things to keep in mind, if you do a discovery search on-premises on a mailbox on-premises, you don't need OAuth. Or if you do a discovery search initiated in Office 365 on a mailbox in Office 365, obviously, you do not need OAuth. Any other cross-premises scenario from on-premises to Office 365, whether it is a mailbox or archive, requires OAuth. So how about FreeBSD? As I said, it's a good example of where OAuth comes into play and definitely gives you some advantages. The thing here is, it only works with Exchange 2013 Service Pack 1 or later. So the tricky part here, if you are running a mixed environment, 2010-2013, you will be using both OAuth for FreeBSD, and depending on where your mailbox is located, you might be using organization relationships as well. So you will be using both interchangeably. And are there some features that do not work? Yeah, cross-premises OR redirection, but that's still being taken care of by the organization relationships, as I said earlier. So how does that work? FreeBSD, in general, prior to Service Pack 1 using Federation Gateway, you have that on-premises user who wants to query FreeBSD information from Joe. So Ben is trying to get Joe's information. The request for FreeBSD goes to the client access server and says, I need the information for Joe. Client access server says, well, I have an object for Joe, but it's not in my organization. I don't have the mailbox. The mailbox is in Exchange Online. And I do have an organizational relationship for that. So what will I be doing? I will be going to the Federation Gateway and get myself a delegation token. I have a trust with the Federation Gateway, so that Federation Gateway will see, okay, you have a trust, you'll get back a delegation token. Then the client access server will make a connection to Exchange Online, and it will ask the FreeBSD information for Joe, and at the same time hand over the delegation token. Because Exchange Online has a trust with the Federation Gateway, it can validate the token, and it will send back the FreeBSD information to the on-premises client access server and be done with it. So how is that different with OAuth? Well, we'll see that right away. In OAuth, there are several steps in between. First of all, when OAuth is configured, Exchange 2013 will always try and use OAuth first. Keep in mind that if you have OAuth configured and OAuth fails, the FreeBSD request will fail. It's not a fallback option, so it doesn't try and attempt using OAuth and then fall back to using the organization relationships if that fails. It will just use OAuth, and stick with it. So that, keeping that in mind, what's the difference there? So again, Ben's requesting the information from Joe, but this time he's going to use OAuth. The client access server goes through the list. Do I have information on Joe's mailbox? Oh yeah, he's in a different environment. So I will then look up if I have an IOC. I do have an IOC. So I will then connect directly to the auth server in Azure, get a delegation token, and then connect back to Exchange Online. And from there, the process is pretty much the same. But we ruled out the Federation Gateway here. Good. Public folders. We're still using them. As I thought, quite a bunch of people are. As a matter of fact, Microsoft recently, I don't know if you saw the blog post on the internet, they phased out public folders internally after so many years of having used them. But the truth is, they're still there. And a lot of Hybrid customers are still using public folders. So how do you go about them? It's one of the ugly things. To me, it's one of the ugly things in Hybrid deployments. Can you do it? Yeah, sure. An on-premises mailbox can connect to a modern public folder in Office 365. A mailbox in Office 365 can connect to a legacy public folder or a modern public folder on-premises. How it works, though, is a little bit tricky. Setting it up might be a little bit tricky as well. But here is a high-level process. So you have an on-premise a cloud user. Logs into his computer, tries opening Outlook. What happens? Outlook does an auto-discover request. Goes to the primary namespace, which is still on-premises, gets an auto-discover redirect to Office 365, does a new auto-discover request to Office 365, and then gets the mailbox information. In that auto-discover response will also be the information on the public folder that you're trying to connect to, or the public folder hierarchy, if you will. That kind of looks like this. The public folder information will contain target address for that public folder. So what happens now? Outlook, and you need the November 2012 update for Outlook 2013, I think. It will then do an auto-discover request for that public folder mailbox. That auto-discover request goes to the on-premises environment, and it will get back the connection information for that public folder mailbox, after which it will connect to the on-premises environment, which will then handle the coexistence internally, whether it's a modern public folder or a legacy public folder, and return the data to your user. So yes, it works. You can set it up. But there are some quirks. One of them being mail-enabled public folders. Today, nor AAD Sync, nor FIM, nor DIR Sync syncs mail-enabled public folders, which means that you wouldn't see them in your global address list, if you will, in Office 365. So the guidance today is that you have to use a bunch of scripts. The scripts are available. They are available on TechNet, and they are also in a scripts folder on the Exchange server itself. They will help you get those mail-enabled public folders synchronized into Office 365, and then you set up a sort of a scheduled task. And that scheduled task will then periodically make sure that all the new mail-enabled public folders that you have on-premises are also visible in Office 365. It is definitely Microsoft's intention to, over time, add that feature into AAD Sync to make sure that you don't have to do these steps manually yourself. But it is what it is today. Good. So let's talk about hybrid management. Most common question ever, can I retire my hybrid servers? So a lot of companies don't want to stay hybrid indefinitely. They just use that as a vehicle to get into Office 365. And once they are there, they want to get rid of Exchange. Well, the thing is, you cannot. You need at least one Exchange server to do the management of the Exchange-related objects. That's the support statement. You need to keep that one Exchange server running. I know it sounds a little bit weird, but it is what it is. You cannot, you know, move away that Exchange server. This being said, that is what the official support statement is. Here's what I'm going to tell you as a consultant. You could get rid of it. Do you want to do that? That's an entire different ballgame. You're not supported. Does it work? Yes, it works. It's entirely up to you to make that decision. But why would you want to keep the hybrid server? Well, first of all, hybrid management of all the objects, all the mail-enabled objects, mailboxes in Office 365. Unauthenticated relay. if you still have some applications on premises, printers, faxes that want to send, or scanners, sorry, that want to send unauthenticated messages to and from Office 365, then the hybrid server is a good way of doing that. Obviously, you could get rid of the hybrid server and set up an SMTP gateway, which works just as easily or just as well, but then again, something that you need to keep in mind, right? So there are enough reasons why you want to keep them, but the most important being, if you ever want to move back from Office 365, having that hybrid server, you just start doing the mailbox moves and you start offboarding people. It's obviously not the scenario that nor Microsoft wants me to tell to people, like, keep it in case you ever want to get out. But it's the truth. You can just have it there, use it for whatever it is. The downside is, as long as you have that hybrid server, and given that it's still a recommendation in the supported state, you need to maintain that one as well. So one of the support statements of Microsoft regarding to the version that you're running on the hybrid server is you cannot lag behind. You need to maintain it. So it's not that you can have Exchange 2013 Service Pack 1 today and keep that version, CU4 or CU5, for the next 2 years. Today we're on CU6. Well, you better move to CU6. And when CU7 gets out, you go to CU7 and so forth and so on. So you need to patch and maintain that server. Is it some additional work for you? Yes, it is. But it shouldn't be a problem at all. So let's talk about hybrid mailbox migrations. First of all, you're not pushing mailboxes to the cloud. They are being pulled in from the cloud. Inbound connection into your environment, that's why the certificates are important. And that's also why you need to think about your security guys and their firewalls. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. So you initiate a mailbox move in Office 365, which then initiates an inbound connection to your Exchange Web Services endpoint, where the MRS proxy is enabled by the HCW and starts, gathering the data and moving it over to Office 365. In Exchange 2013, Office 365, Wave 15, we have the batches, the migration batches, which allow you to easily schedule a batch, move of mailboxes, and they now work, with all types of migrations. And I prefer doing a migration batch over just a mailbox move. I've done it, it's kind of a habit because you can more easily manage them. You have some more reporting functions in there, but it's all up to you whether or not you want to do that. But why is it important to know that it's an inbound connection? Well, when we're talking about throughput factors, that's when it starts mattering. What comes into play when moving a mailbox to Office 365? And I'm not going to walk through them one by one. I'm going to show all of them to you. There is a lot of things here. There is your internet bandwidth. There is your on-premises server. There is the item count. There is the mailbox size. There is the firewall, the load balancer. The amount of mailboxes that you're trying to move at the same time, the size of your batches, when you're trying to move them, it is all important. So I'm going to give you a very old example of when you have a TMG as a firewall, and I'm pretty sure some people still have them as a firewall, but they have a feature called flood mitigation. Well, the thing is, an inbound connection to your Exchange server to pull in data, it's going to be a flood, your TMG is going to recognize that as, hey, I'm being flooded here, so I'm going to throttle that traffic, or I'm even going to block that traffic, because that might not be anything I want to. Same goes for content inspection on your firewalls. That might intervene with the mailbox move. That might cause the mailbox move to fail. So again, if you're in a large environment with silos like a security guy and an exchange guy and a networking guy, then you need to work with one another to sort out these problems here. Now, is there a magic number that I can give you that tells you how fast mailboxes will move? No. I've seen different rates. I've seen rates from a few hundred megs an hour to 1.5, 2 gigs an hour. I've rarely seen anything go over to 2 gigs an hour. And that is even with a 100 meg connection or a gig connection to the internet. Reason being, all of the before. Your on-premises Exchange server's performance is as equally important to all the rest. I've seen great network implementations, huge bandwidth, great firewalls, perfectly set up, but they're, I'm going to say a badly designed or badly implemented Exchange environment with a bad performance. Well, it doesn't get any worse than that. your email data will be read quite slowly from the databases, and it will take a while before they actually move up to Office 365. So again, there's a lot of things that come into play there, a lot of things to take into account. Just make sure that you cover all of those when you do your mailbox moves to Office 365. You have a question? Yes. Try and shout and I'll repeat it. So the question was that he regularly saw, especially in the morning time in the UK, that mailbox moves get stalled. And he was told or heard somewhere that this might be due to the fact that they're waking up in the States. That might be causing some of the delays. Unfortunately, I cannot talk to what is happening in the back or why mailbox moves are being stalled. But I can tell you there are various reasons. Throttling is one of them. So you have to take into account you're in a shared service with a lot of other customers. If you're using too much bandwidth, then obviously you're being throttled by Office 365, which will, the system will tell you, hey, hold on for just a second. There's a lot of other people trying to get into the service as well. I've seen the stalled mailbox moves due to load balancers on-premises environments. There's a lot of, variables that come into play there. Unfortunately, I cannot, confirm nor deny or tell you why it is happening, but, it sounds like it's something that I see quite regularly, and it doesn't necessarily have to be something that you need to worry about, because typically when a mailbox move gets stalled, just sits and waits for a little while, and then after a while it takes off again and moves anyway. But again, it's something that you could encounter, and if it's really blocking you, then I suggest that you work with support, especially if you ruled out that it's anything on premises, to try and find out why they are being stalled. So, common pitfalls, some of the problems that you will be seeing or might be seeing. Federation Gateway certificate refresh. So it has happened before, and it will happen again. And actually, Microsoft did make a change recently and told everyone to refresh the Federation Gateway certificate, the trust certificate used for the Federation Gateway Trust. So the best practice here and a recommendation is create a scheduled task which will periodically update the Federation Gateway certificate so that you do not run into problems like FreeBSD not working. Because basically what will happen if you are still using the Federation Gateway, which most of the deployments will, then if the trust is broken because the Federation Gateway certificate is expired or it doesn't contain the information that it needs, you won't get a delegation token and you won't be able to get the FreeBSD data. It's quite obvious, right? So make the scheduled task. It is true that in Exchange 2013 Service Pack 1, the Federation metadata is updated automatically. But I still advise that, you set up the scheduled task. It doesn't, there's no harm in doing it twice or even three times or doing it manually. But keep that in mind because you will run into issues sooner or later if you forget about this. There's some other things, some quirks as well. Exchange 2013 CU6, the current version. If you deploy the CU6, the version that is available on the internet, then things will break, especially with regards to recipient management. You cannot create user mailboxes. You cannot move mailboxes, change attributes. Why is that? Well, there is an issue with the backlink in some of the XML files. So there is actually a script that Microsoft has made available, which you can run on the Exchange server, which will fix this issue. Or you could just hold off and wait until CU7 comes along and use that, because it would not have that issue. Okay. Another problem, CMC, Centralized Mail Flow, is broken. So I didn't talk about that in depth earlier, but when you set up a hybrid deployment, you essentially have multiple options regarding your mail flow. One of these options is what they call centralized mail flow, where all the mails are being routed through your on-premises environment, both inbound and outbound. That means if a recipient sends a message to an Office 365 mailbox, an external person sends the message, goes to the DMX record, emits record, goes to your Exchange server on premises, and that will then forward the message over its connector to Office 365. If someone in Office 365 sends a message out to the internet, that message will be routed through the connector to on-premises, and from on-premises it will be sent out to the internet. Hence, the centralized mail flow feature name, because it's centralized on-premises. Why would an organization do that? Well, if you have some regulatory requirements which tell you everything that goes in and out, my organization needs to go through a specific process, that is something why you would use that. Well, out of the box in CU6, it is broken. Users in Office 365 will not be able to send messages out to the internet, which kind of beats the purpose of having Exchange, I think. So this being said, two options there. Get into touch with support, get the interim update, if you haven't already, or if you're in the process of deploying hybrid, you might want to wait to CU7. The option or the choice is yours, but that's effectively something that you can think about. So this being said, I do have some time over for questions. I'm going to let you off the hook early because that way you can go out and have some lunch. But if you have questions, please go to the mic or shout it out and I'll repeat it.
CU7, when?
Yes. CU7, when? Unfortunately, I don't work for Microsoft, so I have no idea. But, you know, taking into account the release cadence every quarter, it's going to be due anytime soon. I think within the next month and a half or so. So that's when I would expect it. Okay. Well, thanks, everyone.